The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the Internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
So welcome. This is Business Planning for ACCS Schools. My name is Greg Gianforte. And let me start with a word of prayer, and then we'll dive into it. Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for bringing all of us here today. We just thank you for your provision for us and the glorious day outside. In Jesus' name, amen. So welcome. And I, again, my name is Greg Gianforte. I am an ACCS permanent board member and chairman of Petra Academy in Bozeman, Montana. My disclaimer at the beginning is I am not an educator. I'm a business guy who wanted something better for my kids. Our four children went to Petra, and I'm proud to say that our daughter, our last child, graduated this spring as the first child ever to go kindergarten through 12th grade. So we're really excited. And this is just a dad bragging, but she got a 36 on her ACT. Yeah. So we're excited about it. She's off to Stanford in the fall. So what I have for you today is really just our toolbox, what we use at Petra for business planning. My hope and prayer is that something in here will be useful for you. I'm going to run through this just to give you this. This is not to say this is the only way to do business planning. It just happens to be the way Petra does business planning. Okay? And some of these tools I threw in from my, and my perspective is as a board chair. When my kids joined the school, there were four of them. When they joined, the student body went up by 20%. We had 20 kids, and it went to 24. Today, we have 170 registered for the fall in a community of 35,000 people. We're one of five Christian schools in the valley, so there's a fair amount of competition. We've been growing. We're in a brand new facility. We just broke ground. We have waiting lists for all our younger grades. We just broke ground on a new grammar wing to add eight more classrooms. So we've really been blessed. It's been a tremendous involvement. I've been board chair for about 12 years. I think business planning is really about stewardship and managing the resources that the Lord has given us. And I want to just talk to you that. As I said, I'm a business guy. I've started five software companies. Our last business grew to 1,100 employees based out of Bozeman. We're publicly traded for 8 years. I sit on four nonprofit boards related to K-12 education, ACCS being one of those. So I have quite a bit of experience in nonprofit board governance as well as for-profit board governance. I sit on five for-profit boards currently. So that's the perspective I'm bringing. And I want to present some of this and then have some dialogue, okay? Because there's a lot of very experienced people in the audience here who may have tips and tricks that have worked for your schools, methods that have provided sound plans. I don't think I'm the keeper of all the knowledge here. So let me go through this, and then maybe we'll go to Q&A and talk about this. Again, what I have is really just a toolbox of things that have worked for us. None of these are sacred. None of these are like the only way to do something. It's whatever works in your environment given the people you have. So first, I'm going to list a number of the tools we use and then talk about some of the lessons learned that we've had over the years trying to make ends meet, because I know how tough it is. A lot of business planning in a school is how do we use the resources God's given us to provide an effective education and pay our teachers a reasonable wage. I mean, that's the critical thing. The first thing, and these are in no particular order, our board retreats. We typically do these twice a year. A board retreat We don't retreat anywhere. We just go into the school. Usually that's the one we do in December. Typically in December, it's about time we're starting to think about putting the framework around the budget for the next year. We do an exercise. Typically we do the same thing every December unless there's some other critical thing. And that is we do a cash projection out 5 years based on estimates about increases in teacher pay, about planned enrollment. And this was something we learned from Gene Frost, who wrote a book on Christian school governance, which I would highly recommend. He's not in the classical movement. He runs a school in Wheaton, Illinois. But he toured a whole bunch of Christian schools all over the country and brought Christian business practices to school administration. Gene Frost, it's a good book. So December, what we do is we look at, in maybe 2 or 3 hours in a morning, I try and keep board service time commitments to a minimum. That way I get better performance out of my board members, and I don't get as many resignations. Board retreats for us typically are 2-3 hours. We'll meet from like 7 to 10 o'clock in the morning. It's easy. That works for us. This cash flow projection, really what we're trying to look at is what's the P&L look like for our grammar school versus our secondary? And because the economics are really different in those two environments. And how close are we to break even based on tuition? What percentage of our total tuition is being given in scholarships? And I have a spreadsheet that I'd be happy to send any of you if you give me your email address, which is our template. And you can drop your numbers into it. It's a multi-page Excel spreadsheet where there's a summary on the first page. It says, this is the P&L for grammar. This is the P&L for the secondary. And then there's subsequent sheets that look at various things. And it allows you to see, okay, are our scholarship amounts trending up or trending down year over year? And then it provides some base assumptions about, okay, well, if we increase tuition by 2% this year and we project it out 2%, and this is the growth in enrollment we can expect, are the things coming together or are they diverging? It's been a very useful tool for us. The second thing we use retreats for is to sharpen the tools. We'll take the whole board, and some years, typically every other year, we'll bring the whole board to the ACCS conference. We found that to be extremely useful in vision setting. At other times, we've gone and visited other schools to talk about particular topics. We had some pushback from parents a couple of years ago on helping our high school get ready for college. Our secondary is relatively new. We hadn't done a lot of college counseling related stuff. So we took the whole board and went down to Denver and visited the school that had 4 full-time college counselors. And the whole board just spent a morning with that administration talking about how they did it, what was important. And we came back with a bunch of ideas, and we learned actually we don't need a college career counselor. But now we have one of our teachers doing it part-time, and that was really helpful for us. We picked topics where we think we're weak or need more knowledge, and then we go visit some expert, or we'll bring an expert in. I mentioned Gene Frost. We got so enthused about his book, we had him come in and actually moderate a retreat for us one time and actually built this first financial plan that now we've been updating once a year going forward. So that's the first thing. The second thing, we're not going to be parent feedback. We're not going to be whipsawed by every parent's desire to add Chinese or to whatever. You know, you get these requests, right? That, oh, I think that we really, everyone should play the trombone, you know, or whatever it happens to be. We did start 2 years ago. Every one of our first graders, second graders, and third graders now takes violin. And we're teaching music theory through violin, which has been, it's been a wonderful experience for us. Is it right for every school? I don't know. But it's been really cool. Parent feedback. Typically, you want to be getting this all the time. Our headmaster is really good about being out when the kids are coming in and when the kids are leaving, picking up the scuttlebutt in the parking lot about what's going on. But then we do a formal survey once a year in the spring. We use SurveyMonkey. It's free. And we ask very open-ended questions. And for the first couple of years we did this, we used the results from that survey for our spring retreat. And we'd spend 3 or 4 hours going through every response we got and trying to. And what happens when you kind of immerse yourself is some trends emerge. And we were able to see some things that we wouldn't have seen otherwise. I suggest some questions here, really open-ended. What do you like best? And, you have to develop a little bit of thick skin on this, because I would say in our surveys, 90% of the comments are positive. You know, life-changing. Can't believe what this is doing for my kids, et cetera, et cetera. And then you'll get one that's like, in a response that's mostly positive, there's a couple of pieces of criticism. And this is where we just got to kind of, and you know what? It hurts mostly because it's usually true. And you just got to be open to that. But that's where the opportunity for learning is. So we tend to do this survey every spring. We only ask 2 or 3 questions, like, what do you like best? Where do you think we can improve? Any specific feedback for the board or the faculty? You know, it's really open-ended questions. That makes it harder to tabulate. But, you know, how many families do you have? You know, I mean, you can go through this amount of data and review it. We have our headmaster or somebody on the staff kind of group it by topic. So all the comments, and we also ask what grade are your children in, so that we know if we get a cluster of feedback about the third grade teacher, we can see that kind of stuff. Right? So we do that once a year. And of course, exit interviews with parents that depart. I mean, schools aren't right for everybody, but we make it a process, and our headmaster actually does those exit interviews to the extent that people will talk to us. They won't always talk to us, but we work on that pretty hard to get the exit interview information. When we're revisioning, when we're starting new initiatives, there's a couple of tools here that we use less often, but I thought it was worth mentioning them. SWOT, many of you are probably familiar with it. Strength, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. It's very easy to Google this and you can see it. Whenever we're starting a new initiative, we tend to do this. It's often a good precursor to this financial projection we do once a year. We'll do the SWOT. It takes about, you know, maybe an hour for the board to do it together. What are our strengths? What are our weaknesses? What are our opportunities? What are our threats? Strengths and opportunities strengths and weaknesses tend to be internal. Opportunities and threats tend to be external. That's how we think about it. You don't want 50 things in each category. You want the top 5. So don't make this more complicated than it needs to be. But it's been a good tool for us to kind of focus our efforts. What should we focus on in the course of the next year? We knew we had a problem in our secondary because we had high attrition rates in our secondary. And we'd like to think everybody's there for the academics, and many are. But without sports, we couldn't keep the students in the secondary. Now, we didn't have many people in our secondary, many kids in our secondary, so we had to come up with a sport we could implement. So we did ultimate frisbee. Low cost, takes frisbee and like 4 cones. It's co-ed, so it's easy to think. And I don't know if you know much about ultimate, but it's a great sport. It's self-refed. It's just as likely one team will congratulate the other team for something they do well. And at the end, each team prepares a chant to honor the other team. It's good sportsmanship. And now the only problem was there were no other ultimate teams in the state of Montana. So we got 2 other Christian schools to join our league. And guess what? We're state champions. So now we have a 5-foot by 7-foot banner in the gym that says Ultimate State Champions. But it was one way to build community in our secondary, because when we looked at our weaknesses, it was the cohesiveness of our secondary. And we needed to find something outside the classroom to bring people together. Sports was a way to do that. And Ultimate turned out to be a low-cost way to do it. And in Montana, everything's pretty far away. These other 2 teams, one is 3.5 hours away. The other one's 4 hours away. So we have 3 tournaments each spring where all 3 teams go each location once. And it's great. So now, actually, we won again. So now we have 2 banners in the gym. OGSM, you can look at that. I use that a lot in my for-profit stuff. There's a YouTube video. It's 6 minutes long that describes it. We haven't used it that much in the schools. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but it's an interesting tool. It's used by, I've used it in a lot of nonprofit organizations that I sit on the board of. It produces a one-page business plan that can be very effective. Once you've done the SWOT, that in conjunction with the OGSM, the OGSM stands for Objectives, Goals, Strategies, and Measures, and it gets you like a very high-level plan that, cast in the light of the SWOT, can produce a very productive result. Okay, but again, this is if you're trying to deal with some particular weaknesses or something, the OGSM can be used for that. I mentioned the financial projection. You're not going to be able to see this, but I have a copy of ours up here. And again, if anybody gives me their business card with an email, I'm happy to send you a copy of the actual soft file, which will be a lot more useful than this. This top level, you can't see it, but it's got our kindergarten and K-4 as one separate P&L. Just the summary, income, number of students, net on that area. The grammar school, the secondary, and then it's all totaled up. And then there's sub slides for each of the areas with all the administrative costs in one sheet that then gets prorated back to the other P&Ls based on enrollment. Okay, so basically you can allocate administration back to K-4, grammar, secondary. So you can really get an approximated P&L for each area, and you can see that, I mean, because, as we know, we have one teacher per grade in the grammar school and then subject matter teachers in the secondary. A secondary is a very expensive school to run until you get enough critical mass. This allows you to see what it actually costs you, and it's a very instructive tool. I'll leave it up here if you want to see it afterwards. Okay. Fundraising. I put fundraising on business planning in large part because it's so critical to our schools. I want to share what we do. Because we used to have a big banquet, and we used to sell stuff, and boy, Harold Naylor helped us a lot with this. We've moved away from that. We do some very specific things. We raise $150,000 to $170,000 a year for our little school, and we do it in some specific ways. First, I'd say the philosophy is really based. We don't want to turn our kids into little merchants that are going around selling stuff, because that's not consistent. Anything we involve the kids in is related to their academic work, even if it's fundraising. The way we do that, we run one fundraiser a year in the elementary. We run one fundraiser a year in the secondary, so this does not become dominant. And then we do two other things to raise funds. Let me just walk you through those. In our school, in the fall, in the elementary, we run a spell-a-thon. Each kid has 100 words. It's their normal work they would have done in their classroom anyway. And they go out to their grandparents and parents and get pledges for how many words they can spell correctly. We raise $25,000 to $30,000 every fall that way. With a bigger school, you can raise more. But it has the kids being encouraged and supported by their parents and grandparents at the same time. And we give some prizes and things, but it's mostly about getting the words right. So that's worked really well for us. It's a lot better than selling cookies where you give half the money away. The second thing is the secondary does a theatrical production in the spring. We've done this to replace our big dinner. What we found with the big dinner, it was a lot of work. We'd get big name speakers to come in, and we'd get huge attendance, but we wouldn't get as many checks written as we wanted. We found that when we showcase the kids, there's more relationship building. We get a better result. So in the drama production, we used to do Shakespeare every spring. And then we did this parent survey. And much to the headmaster's chagrin, the number one comment was, can't we do something other than Shakespeare? And again, to Douglas Wilson's comments, I mean, that was a method, not a principle. So we have broadened. We did a great production this spring. Murder in the Air, H-E-I-R. And it's a comedy murder mystery where at intermission, the audience votes on who the killer is. And then there's a different ending depending on who they vote for. I voted for my daughter. But so that drama production, the way we make economics work, we pre-sell play sponsorships. We call every business in the community. It's the only ask we make of the businesses all year long. And once you get somebody to say yes, they tend to say yes the following year. So we typically raise about $30,000 from play sponsorships. And we just print a big banner. There's gold, silver, bronze. Gold is $1,000. Silver is $500. Bronze is $250. And we put their name in the program. We don't deal with ads in the program. We don't do any of this stuff. We just go out and say, hey, we want you to be a sponsorship. And we'll give them some tickets if they want them. But we don't automatically give tickets away because we like to sell those. So there's about $30,000 in play sponsorships. And then we sell tickets. We usually sell about $10,000 worth of tickets. They're only $10 each. But we get 1,000 people of this over 3 nights. The kids love it. It's built real community. I would say our secondary is more of a drama-focused secondary than it is a sports-centered secondary. And then we run a little silent auction at the event, which maybe raises another $5,000. So we typically raise $45,000 from the spring play. And it's almost 30 of it's raised before we open the doors. And the beauty of it is we have families coming to this from the community. It's become an event. The quality of the presentations is so great. People cannot believe that this is a high school production. And they say, how did you achieve that? They say, oh, I'm glad you asked. You know, and so it's one of our best recruiting tools because we're showcasing the kids. And then we do an annual letter in December, typically, to all the families and grandparents saying, this is our budget. This is what we raised in the Spellathon. This is what we expect to raise in our drama in the spring. And this is the gap. Please write a check. And it's just a simple ask. So the fourth and last thing we do for fundraising is in our monthly newsletter, the last page is a wish list. Playground equipment, new lab equipment, lockers for the secondary, whatever it is. It's a laundry list. It's a full page long with the dollar cost, how much has been raised so far, and how much is remaining. And what we find is that, like, we needed some tables for the library. Great. It's $500. Some grandparent gets that, says, boy, I'd love to do something for the school. So we give them a bunch of options. There's no formal ask. There's no pressure on anybody. We just make the need known in the newsletter each month, and it's been a really effective tool for us. I think we've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars over the last couple of years for targeted things. We do not do bronze plaques, but we do allow people, it's not uncommon for them, I bought those tables. You know, so they can do something specific. And there's things there on all ranges of prices and things. So that just making the need known. So those are the four things. Spellathon in the fall, drama in the spring, annual letter in December, and then a wish list in the monthly newsletter. I would say that we're at a point now where any money we raise from our fundraising efforts pays for scholarships. If everyone paid 100% tuition, we wouldn't need to raise any money. That's where we are. That's where the budget is right now. And I think we could do a little better, so our fundraising grew in the capital stuff. We haven't quite gotten there yet. The last thing I should mention on fundraising while I'm on it is we do have an expectation that every board member will write a check every year in addition to whatever tuition they're paying. And that's an expectation. It's part of the job description because there's going to be a gap. And it's got to get filled. And the board puts the budget together. If we end up putting the budget together with the administration that we approve and there's a gap, there's only one place that money's going to come from. That's the board. So we made a decision a number of years ago. We were really convicted. We were running the school on the back of our teachers. The salaries were too low. And that made sense in the early days because the teachers were typically moms with their kids in their school, and it was a step away from homeschooling, and that was okay. But as we grew, we really were convicted that a worker is due their wages. So there was a year where, and we stepped out in faith, and we made the commitment that we're going to pay a market wage, and provide every teacher medical insurance. And we did that. That year, we had a $450,000 deficit we had to cover. That was covered by the board. The next year, it was $350,000, and then $225,000, $180,000. This year, it's $60,000. So it was a, and we finished, this will be our 20th year. We've, you know, it's been an incredible blessing. We finished every year on the block. I have no debt. And so it's been a tremendous thing. I'm not sure that's the route I would encourage everybody to go down. But the Lord will bless your faithfulness in stewardship with the resources. And but I will say, in recruiting board members, we certainly look for people that understand classical and Christian education, have their kids in the school. We make it a requirement in board selection that if your kids are in the school, you're paying full tuition. No one's on our board on partial tuition because our board makes decisions as to who gets scholarships. About 50% of our families are on scholarship. Montana is 49th in the country in wage scale. So our average state wage is $36,000 a year. So it's a difficult situation. But the Lord's blessed our efforts, and it's been good. I'm not telling you anything you don't know here. Economics in the classroom. You know, once you have a classroom and a teacher up front, your costs are basically fixed. So that's why in the early days we were very generous with scholarships. If we could fill a seat, even if they only could pay $1,000 a year, that was better than having the seat empty. Just from an economics perspective. Forget about the opportunity to shape a young life, you know, and mold that person. So as classrooms fill up, certainly things change. But that was our expense. So last I want to run through some lessons learned, and then I'd be happy to have some dialogue and answer some questions. All the advice we've gotten, whether it's from Harold or Gene Frost, you got to charge what it costs. You know, you have to charge what it costs. We originally had discounts based on multiple students. We got rid of those because, you know, if it was unfair. Because if a family had 12 kids but could pay full tuition, why are we giving them a discount? You know, no, I'm exaggerating a little bit. But we don't have any families with 12 kids. Although they exist. Maybe some of you have 12 kids. And God bless you. So no multi-child discounts for us. That was the conclusion we came to. Somebody has one child and they need financial help. We'll give it to them. All of our scholarships are based on financial need of the family, based on the burden that tuition will place on that family, and nothing else. It's strictly financial need. We do, and I'm sure many of you do, we use a third party for financial need evaluation. I mentioned we do pay our teachers a living wage. We tend to benchmark off the public schools for salary level because that's market. We've been blessed now, many of you have seen this, now we're in this a couple of decades, we're starting to get teacher applicants who are raised in a classical Christian environment. What a blessing that is. It's tremendous. Sports, we talked about that. Board must lead in giving. When we interview a new candidate for the board, we make it very clear. If your kids are of school age, they need to be enrolled in the school, you need to pay full tuition, and we are going to expect you to help us balance the budget every year. It's part of your responsibility. And so when I come to them and ask them for a check, no surprises. And, hey, this is the budget you approved. This is the gap. How much are you going to cover? And it's the amounts between them and the Lord, but they need to write a check. So we make a policy. Every single board member writes a check every year for some amount. And I would say they range from a couple thousand dollars to $25,000 a year, each board member, something like that. And that helps a lot. How many people do open houses for their school? How many of them do them like a few times a year? Yeah. This is the best thing we've ever done. We have one every Thursday morning from 9 to 11. Every Thursday morning. And that way, any parent who wants to promote the school can say to anybody, oh, come by next Thursday. You'd have these open houses in the evening. And the teachers all have to come in, and But it doesn't work with somebody's schedule or whatever. So we just do open houses every Thursday morning. And the teachers generally know that there might be somebody visiting the classroom on Thursday morning. It's so much more effective to have a potential parent sit in the classroom for an hour in terms of showcasing the great work that you're doing. So we've moved to this, and we don't do any open houses outside of this every Thursday. And we just make sure there's a pot of coffee on. And sometimes people show up, and sometimes they don't. The headmaster just knows not to put really anything on their schedule for that 2 hours every Thursday. And it allows every parent to be promoting the school and having people come by. It's a really simple idea. We stole it from somebody else, but it's really worked effectively for us. The best, you know, there's a lot of effort in fundraising around, sometimes around grant proposals and these sorts of things. Our experience is we can only really raise money from people that are involved in the school. That tends to be parents and grandparents. It's also the case, you know, if I go, quote, hit up a local business and get a check for $200, it's $200. If I can get parents to enroll their child for the next 10 years at $7,000 a year, where else am I going to get a check like that? Right? So just from a very practical perspective, the most important thing you can do is make sure great things are going on in the classroom and work word of mouth in terms of getting people enrolled. Enrollment is the best path through to you know, financial solvency. So that's what I have for you. That's the toolbox. That's what we follow. I will make one comment. I would ask that you would pray for our headmaster. Todd Hicks, many of you know, he's attended many of these sessions. He was diagnosed with a brain tumor a year ago. He had an operation. He did work well through this year, although he has some degradation in motor skills. Cognitively, he's fully there, but there's been a reoccurrence, and he's just resigned. So he's going to focus on trying to get better, going through chemo. Todd Hicks, if you could pray for him, that'd be great. And it's also placed us in a situation where we are doing a search for a headmaster in Bozeman, Montana. If you know anybody, we really appreciate referrals. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. What questions do you have about anything of this related to business planning? Yes.
How many on your board?
How many on our board? I think we have seven. Seven people. Yeah, I don't think there's a magic number there. Yes, sir.
You mentioned no multi-child discounts. What about for teachers, children?
Yeah, good question. So the question is, no multi-child discount. What about teachers? When we were running the school on the backs of the teachers, we provided 100% tuition compensation for teachers' children. When we went to market wages, we changed the policy. We now do 50% for parent for teachers. Okay, so there's a 50% discount for parent for teachers' kids. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on the philosophy behind that time where you could have a teacher who potentially can very well afford four of his or her own kids there and another teacher that could not afford even one? How do you see that philosophically?
In a part of this is we do allow teachers to also apply for financial aid, so they can get scholarship for that other 50% if for some reason. Now, in a perfect world, we're all you bring your legacy along with you. I think that if we were starting over from scratch, we'd pay market wages and do scholarships for everybody on the same basis. And if a teacher qualifies for a scholarship, then they qualify for scholarship just like somebody walking in off the street. But I don't lose any sleep over providing a little extra help for our teachers. So, yeah.
Do you compel your teachers and board members to enroll their children?
Yes. Yeah, so it is a requirement that teachers and board members have their kids in the school. We have made some exceptions in particular cases, but it is policy that their kids need to be in the school. Yes, sir?
Your stock symbol of your company?
Well, we're not publicly traded anymore. I sold the business to Oracle 2 years ago. No. Yeah.
Can you speak to fundraising for debt-free campaigns?
Yeah, so the question is, can you talk to fundraising for a debt-free campaign? We have no debt. We just finished building a 50,000 square foot building with a full performance hall and a double gym, and we're just breaking ground, and we have no debt. It's not easy. I think at the end of the day, the money is going to come from your community for a project like that, and you're going to need somebody to step up as an anchor to kind of do a big piece of it. We had good support from across all our whole community. We would not have done it without that, but there are a couple of families that carried the bulk of the project, and you've got to cast that vision, and our experience is it mostly comes from within the community, parents and grandparents. Yeah.
I love your idea regarding the drama program, and the question would be, when you're calling the business, do you feel like with your simple plan of gold, silver, bronze, you're projecting the vision and it's just easily received?
I have to give credit to my wife.
Okay.
What we started with was the supplier list to the school, people that have a relationship that get benefit from the school, and the supplier list to our business. And we only ask them once a year. This is your opportunity to support something we're doing in the community. And we tell the story, but it's all relationship. My wife probably makes, she still does this every year. Hundreds and hundreds of phone calls. And we mail out a letter in advance, and it says, you're going to get a call from Susan. And they know that, you know, they're going to get a call from Susan. And probably not one. And no is an acceptable answer. But we'd like to have an answer. And it's not a heavy, I mean, it's really, I don't want to paint it as a heavy pressure thing, because it's not. They see what's going on at the school. These are typically people we invite to our senior thesis presentations. They have some relationship to the school, and they want to help. And this gives them an opportunity to do that. And, you know, they're free to not support, and that's fine. We'll take them off the list. But we do ask the community to come alongside what we're doing, and this is the way they can do it. Yeah?
What kind of church support do you get from the people?
Financial support?
At all support.
Yeah, we don't get any financial support from any of the churches. One exception, we couldn't finish our performance hall. So one church that was meeting in a gym in town had raised about $100,000 to build a building, which is clearly not enough to build a building. But it was enough to sheetrock our performance hall. So we signed, they prepaid a 7-year lease, and our performance hall is now their sanctuary on Sundays. So that was an interesting symbiotic relationship there. We have a number of pastors' kids in the school, which helps. So I would say it's it's not overwhelming, but we have kids from a lot of different churches. We're not affiliated with any particular church. Yeah.
You may have said, is your newsletter electronic or physical?
Yeah. The question is the newsletter electronic or physical? We do both. We try and push people to electronic. If anybody wants to be signed up for our newsletter, I'm happy to put you on it. The Griffin Gazette. Our mascot is a griffin. And we have a 4-foot bronze of a griffin out front that's in a rampart position with his talon on a globe with his wings spread and his beak, like, open. It's very intimidating. You used to see those other Ultimate teams coming in. It's like, oh. Yeah.
On your revenue side, what's your ratio of enrollment dollars versus fundraising dollars?
Oh, we don't spend any money on fundraising.
On the revenue side. In other words.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So our budget this year was about $1.1 million for the school, something like that. I think tuition was $900,000. Yeah, so we raise a couple hundred thousand dollars right now. It's where we are now. We haven't always been there, but that's where we are now. Yeah,
so,
sir.
So you see, historically, costs, you talk about your tuition, would all paid, would cover everything, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's the ideal case, that you take the total costs, you divide by the number of kids, that's what it costs you. And I don't know, Harold, you may have some suggestions on rules of thumb on this stuff, but we'd like to get tuition to 80 to 90% of the costs, and then that makes the fundraising goal a lot less. And honestly, if you could get tuition to cover 100% and then fundraising goes to capital projects, even better. Not a lot of schools get there.
But then that fluctuates in the number of students, right? I mean, if it's a smaller school, it's harder to do.
It is harder, yeah. Yes?
I'm sorry, you probably said this was the size of the school?
We have 170 enrolled for the fall, K through 12, K 4 through 12. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the question was our approach that none of the board members are on financial aid. It's not an absolute. I mean, we do follow that in our school. I wouldn't say that's the way you have to do it. Our belief in that is that, A, we think one of the primary responsibilities of board members is to support the school financially. That's the primary reason. And we're also making decisions. The board makes decisions on who gets scholarships and who doesn't. There's a little bit of conflict there when a board member is actually receiving financial aid. Yeah, Tom.
Hey, Greg, would you give some hard numbers to me? You discussed back when you balanced books on the back end teachers.
Yeah.
What that average wage looked like. And then your market wage, what did that increase? Like, what hard numbers did that?
Yeah.
I realize it's market
driven. Yeah, now you're in Montana as well, so. So this will make more sense to you. The rest of you are going to laugh when I tell you the wages. But when I joined the board 14 years ago or whatever it was, our average teacher wage was $11,000 a year. Now, that is not a living wage, right? That was a little bit of compensation to a mom who happened to be teaching the class. Our starting wage now for a new teacher coming in is $27,000 a year plus full medical benefits. Our top teacher makes, sort of in the 50s. So we tend to give some increase each year based on our hard sciences teachers make more makes more in the secondary. We're able to hire a guy, engineering grad out of VMI, to do our hard sciences teaching in the secondary, which is great. But he's got market opportunities that are different than some of the other teachers. So we were able to get him in the mid-40s pretty quickly.
So they say market wage.
Well, we have the data for the public schools in our community, and their starting salary is about $27,000 a year. Yeah.
And what's your tuition?
In the secondary, it's about $7,000 a year. But again, 50% of the families are on scholarship. Yeah.
Who is your competition other than the government schools?
Yeah, so in Bozeman, or the Valley is about 60,000 people. Okay, Bozeman's about 39,000. There's Heritage Christian, which is like across the street, which when I say, it's the right place for some people. It's not a classical school. There's a Seventh-day Adventist school, Mount Ellis Academy. There's a secular college prep school, Headwaters Academy. Manhattan Christian, which is a Dutch Reformed school. It's been there over 100 years, a couple hundred kids, and then Petra. And we have a huge homeschooling community as well. Yeah, huge homeschooling community. So in the state of Montana, 8% of the kids are in something other than traditional public school. Yeah.
Have you found any way to reach into that homeschool community to bring them into the orbit of the school and perhaps use your facility and generate income out of that?
Yeah, so the question is, have we had a way of reaching into the homeschool community and kind of integrating them? Not really. I mean, we've had a number of homeschool families get to a point where they need more of a classroom environment because mom's not quite ready to do all the math and science stuff or whatever the reason happens to be. That's becoming more difficult because we have waiting lists for all our grammar school years. We don't have as many slots in the later grades anymore, which is a blessing, but it's harder to do that outreach. We do get income. We rent our gym. That gets us about $25,000 a year from our construction project. We've got a bunch of topsoil. That's another $15,000 a year that we get from selling dirt. We did just rent our performance hall for a wedding here a couple weeks ago. Actually, the couple met at Petra, and our operations manager said that she's never doing another wedding. They're a little higher maintenance than the women's Bible study that comes in. Yeah.
Really quick, just practically, the Stellathon.
Yeah.
How do you go? What is the idea there?
Yeah.
There were 100 words do you actually go and send a letter out to the more grandparent driven?
Yeah. So the questions on the details on the Stellathon.
Yeah.
You know, we do this in the grammar school, so K through 6, and each kid is going to be has the 100 words they need to spell. It's a normal part of their class, and there's no new work that the kids are doing.
Yeah.
But we usually have a parent volunteer who organizes this, gets some prizes. They don't have to be big things. And then they get pledge sheets, and the kids go collect pledges from parents, grandparents. They might go to their parents' work and get people signed up. 25 cents a word, $100 if you get them all right. You know, there's different, people can do different, any kind of pledge they want. I'll just pledge you $10, and that's how it's done.
Do you have a big spelling bee, like a big day where to see who the
estimator is? We do. It's not really connected with the spell-a-thon.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, Harold.
When you said every board member is expected to give, who solicits the board members?
Me. As chairman. I mean, solicits the gift?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened, the process is like this. As we start getting visibility into our enrollment for the next year, so this time of year, we start kind of narrowing in on the budget. We've made certain decisions about hiring. We made the decisions on tuition back in January. So the concrete's starting to set up. There's a gap. Whatever it happens to be. I go to the board members and say, please pray about this gap and let me know what you're able to do this year. And so it's really the job of the board chair to do that, I think. It'd be hard. I mean, the board is the headmaster's boss. It's hard for the headmaster to do that. And you need to get support from your chair. There's a question over here. Yeah. Yeah, we limit it to 50%. We will not do scholarship over 50%. Unless they're a teacher, because we will scholarship up to the 50% of what they had to pay in addition to their 50% discount.
What about, do you offer a discount for clergy?
I don't remember. We did it one time. We may have thrown them in the, we'll help you based on your need category. Yeah. It's a couple $100,000. It's basically the gap between tuition and the $900,000 and the $1.1. That was all scholarship money. Yes, sir.
Yeah, when you changed your salary for teachers, did you change the division of the school or the tuition for the students?
The question is, did we change the vision of the school or the tuition for the students? The vision, no. There's been no change. We've been classical Christian from day one, 20 years. And, you know, I really appreciate Douglas Wilson's comments about, you know, avoiding, you know, vision drift. We did have a couple of years, we had been undercharging on tuition. And that was part of the issue. So there were a number of years where we had much larger increases, like 5 to 7%. We didn't do it all at once, but there were like 2 or 3 years where we were bumping 5 to 7% a year. We make it a policy of increasing tuition every single year. It might only be 1 or 2%, But, you know, our teacher salaries go up every year. You know, parents just have to get into the habit of understanding that tuition's going to go up a little bit every year. I mean, we wouldn't raise it if we didn't need it, but the budget's not balanced. And they're very clear that in our budget there's a line entitled board gifts. And those financials are published and everybody sees it.
So that tuition change then, the salary change was a revolutionary
change from one year to the next. Yes. Yeah, we were convicted, but we also knew we had a way to pay for it. Right? So we wouldn't have done that not knowing we had a way to pay for it. I would not recommend that cold turkey approach for everybody. We were convicted. We had a lot of staff turnover because we were paying below market wages. We could really only hire young teachers who quickly started families. We'd get to June every year and be hiring six teachers for the fall. You know, there was no way to do it. We made this change. We've had virtually zero staff turnover, and the quality of teachers has improved dramatically. So there's a lot. There was a lot of benefit in doing it. Yeah, I think this will be the last question. Yeah, so the question is, how do we pick our board members? I now no longer have any students in the school. I'm not planning on going anywhere unless they decide not to have me. We do have a permanent board and a parent representative board. We have a requirement that to be a parent representative board member, your children must have been in the school for at least 2 years. Okay? And then there is a vetting process that the board goes through. It's not a democracy. Board members are picked by the board, basically, and they're vetted with the community. It's much like selection of elders in a church is the way we approach it. So to be a permanent board member, you've had your kids in the school for 2 years, you've probably served as a parent representative for 2 years, and then the permanent board has decided that ideologically we're aligned and you've made a contribution and the individual's willing, and we keep a majority of permanent board members on the board. We have set terms for the parent representatives. The permanent board members are there until they resign or are asked to leave. With a little bit of the question is about homeschool component. In a little bit of experimentation we found it pretty disruptive to the school because they're not fully matriculated. And you get families who are maybe a little further away, they want to have their child in just for Latin or whatever it happens to be. And, boy, it affects the cohesiveness of the classroom. And we've experimented, and we don't do any of it today. But I'm not saying that's the right answer for every community, but that's what we do. Thank you very much. Good.